You are listening to KTWHLP at 99.5 FM in Two Harbors, Minnesota.
Welcome to Living Through the End of Life. Today, Lori Williams will join me in conversation. Lori is a social worker and bereavement counselor at St. Luke's and has much to say about the benefits of hospice, about the integrated services that St. Luke's offers, and about COVID and how it has affected people who die and their loved ones. Join us. I'm Katya Gordon. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Lori Williams, and she is a social worker and bereavement counselor with St. Luke's. Lori, it is a pleasure to have you with us this morning. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Katya. I'm just incredibly honored to be a part of this really important show.
It's such an important and precious topic. First, if you could share a little bit about yourself for listeners.
Sure.
Who are you? How long have you been doing what you're doing? And what got you into end of life?
So I've worked with St. Luke's Hospice as a social worker and bereavement or grief counselor since 2013. And even since my 20s, I've always been really drawn to medical social work because I feel like illness and death is such a fork in the road for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always felt like such an honor for me to be kind of standing there, maybe helping to guide people in a way that might help them find strength in whatever has happened rather than having their lives fall apart afterwards. And so I've always been really drawn to medical social work. And then in the mid-90s, I went back to graduate school at UMD, and one of my classmates had been doing an internship with St. Luke's Hospice Program. And I just hadn't really thought about hospice before, but I was really intrigued by his experience. And so I followed him in that internship the following year, and I was incredibly lucky to have the gift of Kathy McQuinn, who you also have interviewed here mm-hmm. on the show. She kind of took me under her wing as a hospice social worker, and I really credit her for my passion for end-of-life care. She taught me so much and things that I continue to use to this day. I've worked at a number of different places, the Miller Gawne Burns Center and St. Luke's Cancer Center. Also volunteered at Solvay Hospice House for a number of years, and that's honestly probably one of my favorite things I've ever done, just being able to be present with people that are dying. But then in 2013, the person that had been my supervisor at St. Luke's Hospice retired, and I was able to take over this position. So I've been doing this since then.
Like you say, it seems like it is about physical health, disease, and eventual failure, but it's also about mm-hmm. our mental and emotional. It's kind of where they all intersect, and I don't know that it's possible to
right.
acquire a terminal illness or have a loved one pass on without a huge bundle of emotional, spiritual things that go along with that. And I know I'm finding that people I interview are particularly drawn to that. It almost seems like it's not so much a work, it's a calling. I kind of hear that also. Do you want to just explain some of the services that are offered at St. Luke's, one of our local providers? So this will be very relevant.
Great. Thanks for asking. I think all hospice programs and palliative care programs as well have so much more in common with each other than the differences. And that's people that are really passionate and have a calling for, as you said, end-of-life care. And so I think we all have so much in common. That being said, so St. Luke's, we've been in existence since 1980. We were the first hospice program in the area. We're a nonprofit hospital-based program. So we provide care to people within a 40-mile radius of St. Luke's, both in Wisconsin and Minnesota. We provide care at people's homes, at assisted livings, in group homes, and area nursing homes. And one of the differences with some of the other programs is we utilize the patient's primary care physician as the attending physician. So their primary care remains the
yep.
same. And so they write the orders, they approve medication changes and things like that. One of the things we have too, that we have a really active inpatient unit. Most of our hospice patients are home care patients, so we're following them in whatever their home is. But we also have a really busy inpatient unit, and the people that are there are often people that are transferred from other units on the hospital, say ICU or the emergency room or another floor, and their goals have changed from more curative treatment to comfort care. So we continue to provide inpatient care for them as long as we need to until they are able to either be discharged or they die on our inpatient unit. Our length of stay for people tends to be shorter because we do have a lot of people come through our inpatient unit where they're dying in a shorter period of time, say days to weeks.
Sounds like your services managed to be integrated so that there's as little transition as possible as far as relationships with the people who are bereaved.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, they are very integrated. And for a lot of our people, they've had the same primary care physician for 20 or 30 or more years.
Right.
And they love to be able to maintain that relationship with their primary care physician. And then we also have a medical director that oversees all of the care in addition to the primary care physician. But I know that is one thing that, you know, we found that our patients are really happy to keep their same doc that they've been seeing for many years.
Right. Well, totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. Why would you want to switch just because you have a different focus now? And then do you offer anything for after a person is deceased for the family?
Absolutely. And that's where my role kind of comes in. Like many hospice programs, we have a bereavement program. We follow all of our families for 13 months after a person dies in our program. And I know when I first started, I was kind of confused by the 13-month thing. I guess I like even numbers and why would you not end at 12? But I learned that the reason for 13 months is during the 12th month after a person dies, we send out both a handwritten anniversary card and also a one-year mailing to our people. And oftentimes, people will call us after that, and maybe they've not accepted grief support services the entire year. Maybe they felt like they were doing fine all along with our contacts with them throughout the year. But then at a year, they realize, you know, I thought I was okay, but I'm really not. And so at that point, we'll be able to talk with them and see if either sometimes it's just a matter of doing some education or whatever, but sometimes it's also referring them on to either grief therapy or ongoing grief support groups or things like that.
Yeah. It's so funny. As soon as you said that, I thought, oh, but you want to see people through the one-year mark.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. That, and that was new learning for me.
Yeah. I would guess, too, that it would be very rare that you'd actually sort of close the door, and you'd want to make sure you set people up for what they have coming.
Absolutely.
And I can just see exactly what you're saying, because we all just go through phases at all different times. And so an offer for help 2 weeks after your loved one has died is going to feel completely different than an offer 12 months after.
Absolutely. The central purpose, I think, of what I do with hospice as far as grief support, and I have a coworker, there are two that have this role, a lot of what we do is education of people on grief. And, you know, maybe that sounds kind of strange. You know, everybody at some point in their life is going to lose somebody they love, and you think it would be just this natural process, but I do a lot of education about what grief is and what quote-unquote normal or typical grief might look like. And so we do a lot of education and then also validating people's experiences. A lot of people, it's really interesting, feel like they're grieving wrong. I can talk to one person and they'll say, I can't stop crying, what's wrong with me? And then the next person I talk to will say, I haven't been able to cry, what's wrong with me? And so I think it's really interesting, and there's no right or wrong way on this journey. It just is what it is. But I think sometimes it's really helpful to talk to somebody, even outside of your own circle of family and friends, about how am I doing with this on this journey? So I just see kind of myself as somebody who accompanies people and maybe gives some tidbits of information that might be able to help them move forward.
Yeah. It is amazing how so many interviews that we've had on this series, it seems like the real trick just comes down to being present and accepting what actually is. And obviously death is a part of life. It's just so wonderful now that we have people like you to help us just be in the present with what is. And it's so funny you say that about the crying, because I could totally see myself being either way, you know. So it's sort of like, well, what did you expect? Yeah. Like, life is just messy. There's nothing that's different than that.
Yeah. I do think that people often, you know, friends and family, it's our natural tendency to want people to feel better. Which, of course, you want people to feel better, but you can't fix grief. Grief is a problem there's no solution to. You just kind of have to go through it. And it's wonderful if you have people around you that can kind of support you on that. But I think one of the things that makes hospice grief support unique is that we're not trying to fix anything. And even after those first few months, when there's so much support available to many people, you know, where people are calling and checking on them, we still stick around for that 13 months. And we've had so many people say things like, I can't believe that you still call. Thank you so much for still continuing to stay in touch with me, even after all this time.
I wish someday there should be a study where we can follow up for 5 years and then 10. And then I know it's been about 31 years since my brother died, and our family, we celebrated his birthday with a Zoom call, but it was all changed again. Like, just really the 30-year perspective is different than the 20-year perspective.
Right.
And it just is amazing how it's just a lifelong thing.
It absolutely is. Yeah.
Lori, what, to ask you sort of the big question of the hour, COVID, it has obviously changed and intensified many things. I guess I just want to ask you all kinds of questions about that, as far as what your services are that have changed, but also what are people able to do? How do you, you know, as someone who is just very present in not only the natural death, but all the trauma associated with helplessness around not being able to see people or be with them. I mean, wow, what a complication of issues you have been working with. Just any insights and thoughts on that?
Yeah, and it's a huge question and a huge topic. And I mean, there's not a person alive today that hasn't been touched, often deeply impacted by COVID. And obviously, COVID in and of itself has been incredibly difficult. And losing somebody you love in and of itself is incredibly difficult. And then when you combine the two, it's like fuel on a fire, but I don't know which one is which. It's just so deeply impacted everybody. It's impacted the patients. It's impacted the loved ones. It's impacted the staff. It's made the dying process for so many people with visitor restrictions in the hospital and visitor restrictions in facilities, the nursing homes and assisted livings, that has so complicated people's end of life journey. I think we've had more people that have attempted, and some really well and some not so well, they've taken their person home from the hospital or from the facility, really trying to get them so the family could be around them. And you know, a lot of times it worked out beautifully and people were so grateful that they were able to spend that time together. And sometimes people just aren't equipped to take care of their person at home. That being a 24/7 caregiver is, I believe, one of the hardest jobs in the world. Right. But I really give people a lot of credit for it. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's been a lot of missed opportunity for people to be able to say what they needed to say to their person before they died. If you think of sitting at the bedside of the person you love with some guidance, and we try to do that with hospice. I know some of your other people that you've had on the show have talked about the four things that matter the most, or the four gifts. And we talk about that a lot too, both in our hospice program and I do with the bereavement program. But, you know, being able to say thank you, being able to say, please forgive me, I forgive you, I love you, and saying goodbye to somebody and letting them go. And those are hugely critical parts of both the dying process, but then the ongoing grief process, feeling like you have those opportunities.
Right.
And sadly, that's not been able to happen as easily.
Right.
As it had pre-COVID.
Right.
It's been incredible to see some of the innovation and creativity that people have been able to help facilitate, like having Zoom. I know a lot of the hospital staff was helping families Zoom with their person, and sometimes they even would have a computer set up in the dying person's room on 24/7 so family could be present anytime, you know, be able to see the person that was dying, be able to talk to them. So there was a lot of ingenuity, I think, that happened, but it's not the same as being there in person.
Yeah.
And I think there's going to be years of repercussions of that inability to be present with the person. You know, a lot of amazing things that have happened, but I also think there's going to be a lot of challenges moving forward and seeing how this is going to impact people for years to come.
Yes, I think it's just so honest how you put out there that, yes, people have been amazingly creative, but it also speaks to the incredible importance of these conversations and the presence of family that so many families were willing to essentially choose, you know, to forego medical services for the emotional and spiritual aspects that they would gain by being at home, even if it may be shortened life or, you know, in every situation, every family had to make their unique decisions. And I know from an interview a couple weeks ago, Craig Carlson said something that I thought was so wise. He sort of said, we just need to be gentle with ourselves. And, you know, we absolutely did and are doing, you know, our best. But life is just certainly not a perfect scenario. And there is going to be a layer of trauma, like you say, that sort of overlaps so many of the deaths. And we've also talked about the importance of the ritual around funerals and memorial services and the loss or delaying those. Is that really a good idea? Mm-hmm. And what people have decided to do in different families. And it's just all going to be in the wash for a while. Do you have any guidance or advice for people that are either facing the loss of loved ones soon or maybe already have and are wrestling with just such a mixed bag of questions that people are asking themselves right now.
Right. And I don't think there's any right or wrong answer for anybody, but I, like so many of the other people that you've talked to, Ellen probably in particular, am such a believer in the importance of rituals.
Yes.
And those can be any one of so many different things. And I think the funeral providers have, from what I've been hearing from people, have done an amazing job of trying to support loved ones and figuring out ways that they can celebrate their person's life. When you think back years, it used to be that when somebody died, you had a funeral. That was kind of the one option. And that has kind of morphed into celebrations of life and all sorts of other beautiful things. And I think that now with COVID, even more opportunities been made for what those things look like after somebody dies. And there's a lot of people that never would have wanted to have a big funeral. And I've had a couple of people talk about how the person that died was so relieved that because of COVID, and now they didn't have to worry about having a funeral because their person never wanted a funeral. And they felt like COVID gave them permission to not have to do that. And that was really freeing for a lot of people. And, you know, one woman I talked to, I remember her and her husband had traveled a lot and lived in other countries. And after he died, because they couldn't have a live funeral, they did a Zoom or something funeral. And they had over 1,000 or 2,000 people from all over the world that were able to be there. And they had breakout rooms and everything. And she said, we never would have even thought of this prior to COVID.
My sister attended a funeral like that where there were breakout rooms. Mm-hmm. And she felt it was incredibly meaningful in some ways, different, but in some ways even more so because the people that she was connected to with this person, they were all able to be in the same breakout room. And just really fascinating the different ways that we are able to come into our own rituals in the circumstances that are provided for us.
Exactly. I believe that we as humans are so incredibly resilient. But that being said, I think our resilience has been tried to almost the breaking point, or for some people beyond the breaking point this past year. And, you know, I've often talked with people about not only just the big rituals have changed, but even the normal day-to-day things that we do to cope with grief have been impacted, like going to your friends for coffee or having somebody stop by with a thing of cookies or getting together with friends for a walk or, I mean, just those quote-unquote normal things that we do on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
That help us all cope with whatever the grief is, have been so deeply impacted. So people are just kind of sitting with their grief in this big ball. And it's been really, really difficult to know what to do with that.
Yeah, that's a really good and honest way of putting it. I wish there were easy answers for that. It just seemed like we all need to be very aware of our own spiritual and mental health right now and not be afraid to speak courageously about things that we think should be prioritized, I guess.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I just think this isn't just obviously a local or regional or state or country thing. This is a worldwide issue. And I feel like there's so much grief energy that is being held in the world right now. And it's going to take some work and time to kind of figure out our way through this.
Yes.
But I think if nothing else, hopefully that can validate for people that are listening that if they're sitting there feeling this weight of grief, that you're not alone and what you're feeling is normal given the incredibly, what's the word that keeps getting used? Unprecedented. I don't think any of us ever want to hear that word again after this. This is just so unprecedented, and all of us just want something that's precedented at this point, you know, that's normal and feels natural to do. So
And we can think, well, it's not a war, you know, it's not this, it's not that, that have been the typical difficult times in our history. But I also think, so the degree to which these physical and emotional issues are linked and intertwined and very messily mixed in with political issues and other divisiveness, like it just is hard to even figure out what to say, what to think. Will that change next week? And I think that is part of the tendency just to sort of curl up into a little ball, because who even knows what this is going to look like next week?
There's been so much anger too, which I always actually appreciate when people express their anger. I think it's really important to recognize that grief isn't just sadness. It's anger, it's relief. It's, you know, there's any one of a number of feelings that grief involves. But I've just had so many people that have expressed anger and frustration with others, given this whole COVID situation and lack of compassion or caring for each other. And especially if their person died of COVID or if, you know, COVID impacted their ability to spend time with their person, there's a lot of anger and frustration out there too, that I think we're going to need to kind of work through at some point.
So true. Well, and interestingly, I mean, we're talking about end of life in particular, but we're also really talking about a bigger thing because, like you said, everyone has experienced levels of grief and loss during COVID, whether or not they lost a loved one. And so your work is kind of morphing into sort of healing society, I think.
Oh, no pressure there. I don't think there's enough grief therapists in the world. You know, I sometimes, if somebody's really having a hard time, I might refer on to grief therapy. And sometimes, you know, even the waiting list to get into therapists right now is so huge. And that's hard because usually by the time a person has the courage to say, I need more help than what I have available to me, they're needing somebody really soon. And right now, the just waiting list to get into therapy sometimes can be really long.
Yes. Well, luckily, like you say, we are a resilient species. And many of us, hopefully, all of us have someone who loves us who can reach out. Also, maybe if nothing else from this interview, we can all be moved to just reach out a little bit and make sure that the people we know and care for are feeling cared for, and to remember that there is no determining, you know, what's the right way or the best way to grieve, or when grief should end, or what even grief should be about, if it's only about death or if it's about other things as well. So Lori, we're starting to run out of time. Is there anything else you would like listeners to know or think about, or a story that you'd like to share with us? This has really been a delight.
Oh, thank you. Just a couple of things. I mean, one of the things that I like to talk with people about just in doing the grief work over the course of a year is something called continuing bonds. To me, that's my favorite concept in grief. And what that really is figuring out how to move forward in your life without the person's physical presence. Your person's going to be with you for the rest of your life. There's a lot more going on around us than what we can see with our eyes. And I think figuring out ways to keep their presence with you, some examples of that are, you know, wearing your person's clothing or having a gathering even years later, you know, thinking of them, making favorite foods, things like that. The other thing, you know, none of us know how long we're going to be here. And so one of the huge things working with people that are grieving is say what you need to say to people while they're still here. I've talked a little bit, and others have talked about those four things that matter the most, but the forgiveness piece is a really important thing. And I remember a number of years ago when I was working on the inpatient unit, we were having a family conference, and there was a fairly young man, I think in his 40s, that was dying across the hall. And I was talking with the family about the four things that matter the most. And, you know, I forgive you, please forgive me. And the brother of our patient stood up and he stopped the meeting. I still get goosebumps when I think about it, and said, I need to go tell my brother I'm sorry. He said, we have butted heads our entire lives and I can't let him die without saying I'm sorry. And he left the meeting and went across the hall and spent some time alone with his brother, who was unresponsive at the time, but we, you know, believe that a person can hear until they're not physically present anymore. And he apologized, and his brother died within a number of hours after that. And for the rest of the living brother's life, he will know that he was able to say what he needed to say to his person. And that can change everything. When somebody dies, they move on to where whatever your belief system is, but we're still here kind of to cope with the loss and also with the things we wish we would have said or done. And so that I feel is really important. And then it just probably the last thing is I just really encourage people to do end-of-life planning. I loved the show that you did with people that talked about doing healthcare directives and wills and estate planning. Oh my gosh. Every day I talk to people that are so overwhelmed with coping with all of the stuff that has to happen after somebody dies.
Right.
Legal stuff, financial stuff, paperwork, and belongings. Oh, you know, honestly, it's so sad and kind of a both funny and sad story regarding belongings. I remember a number of years ago calling a gentleman whose parent had died. It was the second parent that died, so he had to go clean out the house. And I asked him how he was doing. He said, you know, I don't even have time to think about my grief right now. I need to figure out what to do with all these empty Cool Whip containers. And oh my gosh, we laughed. And, you know, we talked for a bit longer. And I've thought so much about that. And it's not just about Cool Whip containers, but it's about all this stuff that we have.
Yeah.
And somebody has to do something with it at some point. So I encourage people to take care of their stuff, downsize, get rid of things, because somebody's going to have to take care of it. And it really does, sometimes for months or years later, detract from the grief process. And the very final thing, I obviously fascinated with grief, and I also love rocks, like a lot of us up here in the North on love rocks.
Yes.
But what I've come to believe the grief process looks like is after your person dies, it's kind of like, and we've all seen them, these sharp, jagged boulders or stones that we find, and they're just kind of sharp on all the edges. And when somebody dies, it's kind of like that feeling in the center of your chest. Grief can be very physically painful, and it kind of hurts all the time. And over time and not just time, but it takes some work, too, to get through the grief process, you know, laughing and crying and talking about your person and dealing with all of the other issues that come with the grief process, it's kind of like waves on the rock or rain on the rock. And over time, what happens is it smooths the rough edges so that rock or boulder is no longer jagged and sharp, but it's smooth like the ones we see on our beaches that have been tumbled. And it doesn't make it go away. You can still feel the presence of it, just like you can feel the presence of your grief, but it's not as painful. And that presence is about love. And grief, in the end, is all about love. And you're left with that forever. That will never leave you. And they'll never leave us.
And we have all those wonderful beaches here on the North Shore to remind us of these rocks that have been there forever, and they have softened into something beautiful to touch. That's a beautiful nugget of wisdom and a wonderful analogy. Thank you so much, Lori. This has been just such a good conversation. You've left us with quite a few nuggets of wisdom and wonderful stories. You give me hope that we have been through a lot and we will continue to struggle with it, but there are avenues through this that will bring us to a better place. Thank you so much for that. And I will put your biographical information and your contact information in our resources page so that listeners who would love to chat with you more will have access to be able to do that.
Please do. Thank you so much, Katya. And it was an honor to be with you. Thank you again so much for doing this show. I appreciate it more than I can express.
Oh, well, it has been wonderful for those of us doing this as well. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And until next time. Thank you for joining us today. Next week, Katie Van Ness will be joining us. Katie is the coordinator for hospice volunteers at Essentia Health. Whether or not you have ever considered becoming a hospice volunteer, I hope you can join us. A listing of books mentioned on today's show, as well as music you've heard, can be found on our website at ktwh.org. An extensive book list about death and dying, as well as area resources and archived copies of this series, can also be found there. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, please contact us at the station 218-595-6195 or email me at Katya, K-A-T-Y-A, ktwh at gmail.com. All feedback is welcome. Living Through the End of Life is made possible by a team of volunteers. Thanks to Peg Zahorik, Ellen Huffschmidt, Julie Johnson, Jan Swanson, and Chris Belfield for their production support. To Paul Hansen for his website expertise, and Bruce the Moose for putting it all together on the program grid. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.